Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play.
You'll have access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. Gaia has one-of-a-kind shows like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space, Unearthing Nazca, and False Flags.
Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. GAIA.com/expandedperspectives. All one word, GAIA.com/expandedperspectives. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And you guessed it. As always, sitting across the table from me, the birthday boy himself, Mr. He needs a walker now. He's lost most of his hair. It's gray. And he's got dentures. Kyle, I like to gum my food, Filson.
Hello, everybody. Yes, a year older. Thank you for all the warm birthday wishes. I know we already talked to the elite members about this, but if you're not an elite member, then I just want to wish you many thanks from the Filson family. I like the birthday wishes. I appreciate it. If I didn't get to each and every one of y'all, I apologize. I was overwhelmed with a lot of things. I was mentioning on the Elite Show, between work and the kids being out of school and baseball and everything else that's going on, I feel like I've been running in a million directions. So I cannot wait for school to start to give me a little peace, a little break.
He was so happy with all the messages he sent in the studio and just wept. He just took time and wept, just cried.
Just cried and cried and cried.
I held him, I rocked him like you do a child, a scared child. Held him in my lap, patted him on the back, and he wept.
I appreciate it. Right? What's new, brother?
Man, oh man, I'm just right now, if y'all are hearing this, I'm catching fish. I am reeling in redfish, I'm reeling in trout. I am in Florida.
That's right.
Fighting for my life. I am actually on the kayak right now. If you're listening to this, I am out in the middle of the water as we speak.
In shark territory?
In shark-infested waters. Yeah. We are recording this, of course. Like we said, we're not going to let y'all down. We're going to go ahead and always give you a show. We never miss. We always come out. And right now, we're always going to come out with this. Hold on. That's a cold beer that I'm drinking before I get ready to go home and pack up the rest of my gear.
He's in Margaritaville. Right, I mean, just because he's on vacation doesn't mean you are. So We're going to keep producing shows regardless of vacation time or not.
That's right. And we reached out to a good friend of ours, our bud, Mr. Mouth of the South, Micah Hanks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got some stuff to talk about, and we got to talking to him, and we're like, hey, let's just do a show. While we're doing all this, let's just record it. I mean, while we're rocking and rolling and chatting. Because there have been marathon chats that we've had with Micah before, unrecorded, that may go 4, 5, 6 hours. And so we were like, look, let's just start recording and let's just start having a good time.
Yeah.
So
as far as fellow podcasters, I probably speak with Micah more than any of the others.
Yeah.
I mean, literally like every 2 weeks, we at least have a phone call about something. Most of the time it's techie stuff. Like, hey, did you see this new gadget or did you see this new app or software or something? We constantly fill each other in. But, man, he's an interesting guy. He's an author. He's written several books, and he's re-releasing a book that came out a couple years ago.
He wrote a book back in 2010 called Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, The Search for Sentient Intelligence from Other Worlds. And he's packed in, I forgot how many more pages he's packed and redid this. And it's one of his, you know, people love this book. So they are re-releasing this book, and it's going to have all this stuff on it now. So he's going a little deeper. Basically, it's the inner realms of human consciousness, and like we talked about, modern mystics and secret agent magicians, and it's a really interesting book about the unseen realms of consciousness. And like what we've discussed in the past, could it have, you know, is it a veil that we're living in, and then there's these creatures that we report seeing and people report on are really there. We just don't see them in our everyday lives because of the screens or the blinders that we have up. So it's a really neat book. So I'm glad that he's re-releasing.
Yeah, he's an incredible author. He's written other books like the UFO Singularity, as well as the Ghost Rockets and the Maverick Guide to Podcasting. He's the host of the Graylian Report. You can hear that on KGRA with him and Hobbs there. And well, there's not going to be any news this week. We went on so long. Every time we have Micah on, it's a long show. So we're just going to get right into it. So let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Folks, I don't know how to say this any other way. Sometimes, in this wild thing we call life, you bump into certain individuals and instantly you're like, that dude should have been family. Or that old gal should have been family. This is somebody that you can bring into your circle and they don't miss a lick. There's no like slipping a gear. It's not like you got to work or anything. It's just like, boom, they pop in. You're like, man, it's about time. It's like an old soul that you used to know and all these other parallel universes just showed up beside you and y'all are picking right up where you left off. And the person I'm talking about is this Joker that we got on the other line, and we're going to be discussing some ancient history. We're going to be discussing maybe the search for sentient intelligence. We're going to be discussing lots of things today, folks. We've got the Mouth of the South himself, Mr. Micah Hanks. Micah, what's going on, Mike?
Man, I am I'm doing so fine, so well. If I were any finer, there would be two of me. So I'm doing really good. And the trifecta has reunited. So good to be back in the company of the two of you guys. How's everything down further south?
Man, oh man. Well, actually, it started to dry out some. Everything's going great. Everything's going. We're going to have to get you back down here. It's been too long.
Yeah.
Man. We got to get you back down here. This time you need to come when it's cooler. The last few times you've come, it's been warm. This time you got to come back when it's cooler so we can actually go out and have some fun.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was just telling Kyle that the other day on the phone, and it's funny because I go through phases where Kyle and I will be on the telephone, you know, once a week, and then I'll be texting every other day with Cam. And so I've been going through the Cam phase the last couple of days. But last time I was talking to Kyle, well, I guess, which that wasn't the Black Snake time. You remember the back?
Yeah.
That was almost as good as the boat times. Do you remember the boat times, Howard?
Yeah, I remember the Black Snake. Like, we were literally talking about something, and he had to stop for a second because there was a Black Snake trying to get in his house. And so he caught the thing and then put it back in the woods. And then 5 minutes later, he calls me back and we resume our conversation. And then he's like, oh no, it's coming back again. So he hangs up with me and then proceeds to put it back in the woods. He calls me back. We start talking. And then it starts trying to come back again. And he's like, you know what I'm going to have to do? I'm going to have to put this thing in a pillowcase. And I know exactly where to take it. I'm going to put it in my car. And I'm going to drive down the road and I'm going to release it down by this creek. Well, I'm on the phone with him as he's driving. And he goes, oh no. And I'm trying to mentally picture what's going on in the car. And he's like, it got out of the bag. So now he's driving and there's a black snake loose in his car. I'm waiting to hear a screech and a crash, screams from a small girl. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I believe Micah was able to successfully open the car door, release it on the side of the road. And then if that's not crazy enough, when he got back, another black snake. And he didn't know if it was the same snake returning or that snake's mate. Now, Micah, the herpetologist, can you tell us any more about that fateful day?
Let me clarify a few things. Yeah, a pillowcase is often preferable for transporting these snakes, and it would have had a harder time getting out of the pillowcase rather than the hat box that I decided to put it in.
But that's what it was.
Yeah, I was on the phone with Cam, and I said, or Kyle, and I said, Kyle, listen, there's a black snake, and it's coming over into my yard. Now, I don't mind black snakes. I like having them around, but this old girl was trying to get up onto the porch, and she was really interested in the house, and I thought, you know, I would love to have her around. They'll cut back on rodents. They're actually really good to keep, in your neighborhood if you got them. And I always, ever since I was a kid, I used to really worry about my neighbors because they would love to just chop up snakes, chop them to bits. And these non-poisonous snakes, they're not even aggressive. These things won't hurt you, and they will definitely keep rodents and other things on the DL. So I saw her coming, and I thought, well, maybe I can keep her in the neighborhood, but just not in my basement. So I finally picked her up, put her in a box, and put her in the car. I'm driving up the road, and I told Kyle at that point, I said, I'll call you back. And sure enough, I'm driving up the road, and I hear this, and I'm thinking, how's she making that noise? I look over, and the snake is escaping into the car with me. And I think, okay, this is getting interesting. And so I just roll down the window, and we have this kind of a mind meld where the snake looks over at me, and I look at her, and I say, now look, I think we both know what we want here. And she says, I think we want the same thing. And then she goes right out the window. And so she's almost out. And I reach over and I just ever so gently lift her derriere and help her the rest of the way. And so she's out and she flops into the road and goes into the woods and all is well. And I turn around and I come home and I call Kyle. And I'm like, Kyle, I'm so sorry, man. And about that time, here comes another black snake. And so when I see the second one, I'm like, Kyle, I got to deal with this. Apparently it's a biblical plague or something. going on up in here, up in Asheville. And literally at about that time, not only a second, but then a third black snake is following that one. But you know what it was? At first, I thought I'd separated a pair of black snakes traveling together, and one was the mate while I was close. What it was the first, this is their season when they are mating, you know, early spring like that, and the first one was a female. And what happened after that was there were a couple of males that were following her. And when I removed her, the two males were going all around my yard because they couldn't find her. And they could follow her scent. And I used the same little metal rod that I used to gently put her into the hat box. And I brought it over to the black snake number two, I guess. And he followed the metal rod because he could smell her scent on it. So that's what was going on. I finally figured it out. I mean, it didn't take that much to figure it out. But I mean, at first, again, imagine my astonishment to see three black snakes just like they're just coming in droves from my house. I'm like, what is going on here? I really thought, you know, I was about to get struck by lightning or locusts or something. We're going to start descending from the skies. I didn't know what to think.
Well, when you're not practicing herpetology, you're a writer, an author, and you've been working on a book that you started many years ago. What year did the first edition come out of Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule?
Yeah, it was my first book, and, the original edition, I guess, was published in 2010, but, you know, that book took a long time to write. I think it took me altogether about 2 years, and I took a short period of maybe 3 or 4 months off and then got back into it and then just really just kind of plowed through it and got the rest of it done. Arguably, it's the longest book that I've written, and as a matter of fact, the original edition that was published in 2010 was longer than the Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting, which is, you know, again, presently, I guess you might say, my longest book. The new edition, however, of Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, and I haven't said a whole lot about this. I haven't gone on any other shows, so you guys are the first show I've really gone on, apart from my own, where I've even mentioned this. And all the better, too, because you guys are my broods. But the new edition, it's about 125 or 130 pages longer than the first edition, so there's a lot of new content, Totally reformatted, revised, expanded, updated, edited again, and of course new cover artwork. So, I mean, it's now, I think, more the book I wanted it to be. But what's neat is you go back and look at what you had to say 7 years ago, and I was in a lot of ways a different person. But I think the fundamentals of who I've become were definitely still there. Even a lot of my skeptical attitudes toward things was definitely still there. But I've kind of, you know, without completely rewriting the book, I've kind of emphasized the necessity for good skepticism paired with an open-mindedness when approaching things scientifically, because that's one of the big issues I see. And the whole point of the whole book, at the time I wrote it, and even more so now, is to drive home that point of, well, what are altered states of consciousness? Can we learn things from them? Even if we understand the mechanism in terms of what physically causes them, does that unto itself explain what these things are, or is there an actual reason why they occur, and thereby a deeper meaning? And what I've come to find is really that modern science, and we do need to be scientific, and I do try to allow science to be what leads where I go with my research, but the problem I see is that modern science, rather than truly trying to explain these things in the kind of terms I'm talking about there, really understand, well, what does this experience mean, rather than, well, this is what causes it, there it goes. Nothing more to, you know, be said. I mean, if you're going to understand something, what is the reason for that experience? Is there such a thing as a reason? And are we really explaining the experience, or are we just explaining away and then dusting under the rug?
Yeah, we've mentioned a similar thing on the show from time to time. When people, you know, whether they're taking mushrooms or LSD or whatever's helping them reach this altered state, does it really matter if they are truly experiencing these things, or is it just that they're perceiving these experiences? Either way, the person walks away with the same result. To them, It seemed real. And so does it really matter if it really happened, or if it's just, I don't know if the word's imagined or hallucinated, but they walk away with the same effects. Throughout your research, what did you find?
Well, you know, first of all, Kyle, I really think that there is an imaginary component, and you can't deny that there's a hallucinatory component, especially when we're talking about the use of things like entheogens. This would essentially just mean a molecule or substance that is God-releasing. That's literally what entheogen means. Examples of entheogens, like you mentioned, would be psilocybin or magic mushrooms. Dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, which is fascinating to me because not only is it one of the strongest and most potent in terms of not only its actual strength, but the way that the hallucinations occur when under the influence of DMT. They're extremely vivid, often very colorful. One term that is often used to describe them is kaleidoscopic. There seems to be, and as I talk about in the book, a lot of continuity between people's experiences. People with DMT often describe entering kind of almost what they would liken to be a medical environment. Some people, and there was one DEA-approved study that I know of that occurred in the 1990s that Dr. Rick Strassman carried out, where people who would undergo multiple situations with different it was typically in the same laboratory, but I mean they would actually be administered DMT on separate occasions throughout the course of the study, but they would return, they said, to a similar environment from experience to experience. And in at least a few cases, the people who were having these hallucinations said that under the influence of DMT they would return to the same environment and re-engage with the same quote-unquote beings that they remembered from that experience. Now, it's quite obviously hallucinatory. It's quite obviously as a result of using DMT and injecting it into these patients, but the continuity between the experiences and their alleged interactions with beings, I don't know that we can say that they're engaging with fractal aliens on another dimensional plane. Some people do see it that way. But the things that I want to know are, if DMT can cause this experience to happen, and this seems to mirror other aspects of fringe literature, for example, UFO or alien abductions are often compared with the DMT experience, and there are other kinds of mystical or ecstatic experiences that are compared to the DMT experience. That's one thing. You know, is there a continuity between varieties of experiences that people liken to having contact with non-human intelligence? Two, if that occurs and DMT is produced in the body, what function is it intended to have, and why does it have this effect on humans? Is it something that's integral to humanity? Is it something that at one time, perhaps in our evolutionary development, that played a more important role than it does today? So all of these things are the things we're trying to understand, and I don't think you have to approach this subject in the, you know, literalist interpretation of things. That's the problem. Many scientists and skeptics these days would look at a person who, for instance, reads the Bible and interprets it literally, and they would say, that's just foolish. You don't understand the difference between folklore and whatnot. And yet if we try to talk about the DMT experience and say, look, guys, we know it's a hallucination, but, I mean, can we understand the deeper meaning behind this experience? There's almost this kind of reflexive literalism where they look at you and they say, so in other words, you actually think that these people are talking to aliens. That, let me just be clear, is not necessarily what this experience entails. That is one interpretation that some have put forth. What I want to try and understand is what causes altered states of consciousness. Now, I know it seems easy. You take drugs and you trip. But there are a variety of things in the book that I discuss that can cause an altered state of consciousness. Another one, for instance, that really fascinates me, guys, is called the OBE, you know, out-of-body experience. This is a kind of an experience which many liken to being an altered state of consciousness, but this one's a little more complex. A recent study that appeared in Scientific American discussed this and suggested that OBEs are probably, again, a hallucination that is caused by an inner ear problem that some people have. People, 20% or so in a clinical study that had inner ear problems were more likely to experience OBE-type effects. But many people I've spoken to, this experience occurs under very explicit conditions, namely when they are either threatened, if they are in a high-stress situation, i.e., you know, a kidnapping, or they're being beaten, someone is, again, in a near-death kind of a situation, or someone actually has been pronounced clinically dead, either as a result of an accident or injury, or if they are in an operating situation, they're under the knife and they've undergone anesthesia and they're having a heart surgery. All these kinds of things, people, and I've had numerous descriptions told to me firsthand by friends, family, and people I've worked with, and people who have come to me as a result of this kind of work wanting to express their experiences. The OBE to me, again, while modern science calls that a hallucination and that these people couldn't really be some part of themselves tangibly leaving the body and seeing themselves, that couldn't be, so it's obviously a hallucination. That's what science says. But again, the continuity between the descriptions of people who in these high-stress or life-threatening experiences leave their body and see themselves and see their environment, that is fascinating to me, and I think that we at least owe it to ourselves to ask, is there a component of human consciousness that can exist apart from the physical body that could explain the nuances of this OBE experience? So, I mean, all of these kinds of things, these are the kind of questions. It doesn't just have to do with drugs and hallucinogens by any means.
Yeah, and I find the subject fascinating, not just the fact that there's these other parallel dimensions that somehow people are able to tap into, but we know that throughout history, many cultures have been using these things, whether you're talking about the Amazon jungle, the shamans there experimenting, what is very popular now, ayahuasca, another one I think is ibogaine. And there's research is showing that people who suffer from addiction to like cocaine or heroin or these bad drugs, if they go down and they sit with a shaman or something and they have a couple of trips on this ibogaine or ayahuasca, it helps them. It helps them get over their addiction. It helps them reflect on themselves, and it seems to positively impact their lives. And there's numerous cultures throughout the world, going back to ancient times, where the local shaman or something, they were doing these trips all the time, and it seems like they were aware of it, and it made them a better person, more peaceful, things like that. Throughout your research, did you find anything on this new craze that seems to be going around with this ayahuasca?
You know, the ayahuasca is not really anything new. I mean, of course, culturally, it's been in use for God knows how long in South America. It was first discovered by missionaries in the 1950s. At that time, they referred to it as telepathine because the shaman that used it described the apparent psychic effects of using DMT. Now, well, rather ayahuasca, but you got to keep in mind, again, the chemical component that is hallucinatory in ayahuasca is DMT. Now, DMT itself, let's talk really quickly about this in medical science terms. It's not actually an orally active substance. You couldn't just, brew a DMT tea and then drink that and just, you know, see all kinds of dragons and flowers and things. It's not orally active unless it's combined with a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. Now, the varieties of ayahuasca that are consumed in the South American jungle, all throughout South America, particularly Peru, Brazil, I think is really kind of the heartland, you might say. Not all varieties of the yagé or the ayahuasca are hallucinatory. But the ones that are combined with a key component, well, a number of key components. The liana vine, Banisteriopsis capi, that grows in South America, there are varieties of it that grow in other parts of the world too. When I was in Belize, I actually recognized it, and I asked, we were on an ecological tour, and I asked them, what is this vine? And they said, oh, that's liana. So I actually saw a variety of the liana. That is the That is the actual vine that presents the chemical components, the inhibitors that allow DMT to become orally active. It isn't broken down in the body after consumption, and it allows it to become orally active when taken. So that's really how it works. As far as DMT being a craze, what's interesting is that, again, while discovered in the 1950s, the Catholic Church, who were sending a lot of the missionaries down to South America, they thought it was demonic. Anything that they would call telepathine and that they claimed had psychic effects must be demonic. They wanted to try and wipe it out. Fortunately, that never happened. You might call it sort of a New Age movement, but today, again, I think it's more than that, in my opinion. I think that people are beginning to realize, John Hopkins University doing studies with psilocybin and, you know, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, and they're finding that administered to people who are depressed or who are ill or who are going through grief after the loss of a loved one, any of these kind of things, that often it has positive effects that resonate for years and change, you know, a lot of the ways that people see things and interact with others and go about things in their lives. Ayahuasca, unlike the happy trip of magic mushrooms, it's a very intense experience. You know, you drink this tea. Often it's paired with other things like a nicotine-rich tea, a lot of different things that you'll do when you go to one of these ayahuasca retreats. And then what happens is basically there's this kind of a purge, a cleansing. It makes you sick as a dog. I mean, you've got it coming out both ends. You got to wear a diaper. You aren't able to care for yourself, so there have to kind of be chaperones around that take care of you. But yes, you, for a long period, I mean several hours, experience these visionary hallucinations. And interestingly, when I wrote Magic Mysticism and the Molecule, I had in the back of my mind a bit of an idea of who Graham Hancock was, because as a child, I recalled him talking about his theory about where the Ark of the Covenant might exist in Ethiopia. And I'd forgotten about that and didn't come back around to it for years. And so at the time I wrote Magic Mysticism and the Molecule, I had not read any of Graham Hancock's research. When the first edition of the book came out, people began to compare this book. They said, you know, Micah Hanks is this young guy, and he's kind of following in the footsteps of Graham Hancock and some of his more interesting and spiritually themed research rather than his archaeological stuff. And I thought, okay, I got to check out Graham Hancock. And I finally got around to hearing him on the Joe Rogan podcast talking about his ayahuasca experiences. Again, they were not pleasant. Santha, his wife, was all but tortured during her experience. And she said that these beings explained to her that we're doing this for Graham. And they basically told him that, you know, your life is being lived and led by your addiction to hashish. The green bitch, as he calls it. And so he learned after his ayahuasca experience that, he had to back off using drugs so prolifically. And many people who go through the ayahuasca experience, I mean, it takes them in a metaphysical, mystical kind of way. It breaks you apart. It shows you who you really are. It reassembles you. Now, I haven't taken ayahuasca. I do want to do it one day. But again, it's you have to travel to be able to do it. Of course, it's illegal to do in the United States. There may be some rare exceptions for religious practices, but I mean, again, it's not the kind of thing that you can just go down the street and go to an ayahuasca lodge. But for those who do it, yeah, they do describe often this kind of a reshaping of themselves, and that there is indeed a benefit to it. Whether or not one can call it a practical benefit, it is something that shows you it shows you absolutely in the purest sense who you are. The weirdest thing, though, I mean, I'll just add this too, guys. With ayahuasca, a lot of people describe, I mean, there are a variety of different experiences. Sometimes you are shown something. Many people refer to Mother Ayahuasca as though it speaks to them. Dennis McKenna, the brother of the late Terence McKenna, talked about being shown the Banisteriopsis capi and the spirit of the planet, and he said that over his left shoulder, he heard a voice that said, "You monkeys only think you're the ones that are in charge." And during a lot of these mystical experiences, whether they're hallucinatory as relates to drugs or whatever else, people describe, even with sleep paralysis, they describe hearing a voice that comes over the left shoulder. So I don't know what the significance of that is per se, but one of the most fascinating ayahuasca stories that was ever told to me was told by my friends Neil and Jamie, who went to Peru. They were not drug users previously, but they went because Neil had some separation issues that he was dealing with from his late father, who he lost in childhood. And during the experience, he recalled three points of light, or little glowing areas of light, you might say, that approached him slowly. And they came into this kind of a ring of light that dropped down. And he was so excited that he felt the presence of what he perceived as beings in this ring of light. And he said that it was almost annoying when a fourth light began to kind of waver off in the distance. It was bluish in its moving slowly and coming toward him, and he said it was almost a distraction. And he says the blue light enters the ring, and it comes toward him, and it comes into him, and he realizes, he recognizes it. He feels this presence that he hadn't felt in so long. He recognized it as his father. And so in the heart of this ayahuasca journey, of course, with all the sickness and the, you know, the unpleasant aspects of it, I mean, here he is having this incredible reconciliation he feels with his father. And he said that he had to get one of the chaperones over. He said that, you know, I realized after a while I had my father in me, and, you know, that I needed to end the exchange. But, you know, I, of course, wanted to keep him with me. But he said I felt moved to go outside and had one of the chaperones help me out into the cold night air. And he says, I looked up and I saw the stars. And he said, I lifted my hand and the blue flames just shot off into the sky. But he said, I mean, the ayahuasca completely gave him this incredible, this almost otherworldly, I mean, it's in every sense of the word, it's an otherworldly experience. And he said, it absolutely changed my life. I no longer had the anger. You know, I was able to have that final moment with my father. And that's what's fascinating, is whether it's ayahuasca or it's the grief counseling of Raymond Moody or somebody with his psychomania, and we can get into that in a moment too, a continuity that I'm talking about. You know, the kinds of things that you'll see from experience to experience are often people are interacting with, they feel the presence of a deceased loved one, you know, or some other kind of a consciousness that is interacting with them during these experiences.
Well, I'm glad you're touching on something along those lines, because there was something I wanted to bring up, and it's going to kind of derail the show, and I know it's going to happen that way, but we all three lost a pretty good friend here recently, and I was hoping you would touch on some of the fun that you had standing around and chatting with Mr. Jim Mars.
You know, that doesn't derail the show, actually. I mean, what better to bring up as I'm talking about, you know, our deceased loved ones. You know, we were together and saw Jim right before, well, not right before he died, but I mean, we saw him last spring. Little did we know, the three of us, when we saw him in Eureka Springs, that would be the last time we saw him. And I know that you guys got to meet Jim several times and talk with him. The way I met Jim Mars was he came up to Asheville years ago and was doing an event that Joshua Warren had sponsored, and he brought Nick Redfern up too. And so we were all hanging out. I mean, we were all staying at Josh's house that entire week. And so, I mean, we're just going around town. You know, we were stopping and having beers, you know, having dinner together. I mean, I got to know Jim Mars really well that week, and he was just a wonderful guy. He was hilarious. A lot of fun to talk to. And, you know, he was somebody who was unique because he was a trained journalist. But one of the things that he told me was that the week before the Kennedy assassination, that he had been in Jack Ruby's nightclub. You know, that was probably just one of the places that he went. Mm-hmm. Being a Dallas native and everything. He worked for the Star-Telegram. You know, you guys remember the story of the Fort Worth Monster. And we went out with Lyle Blackburn there to Lake Worth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this urban legend. And for those, anybody out there in the listening audience who isn't familiar with the Lake Worth Monster, if you listen to Expanded Perspectives, I'm sure you probably do know about it. But if you go look in the Star-Telegram's archives and you dig up that first newspaper article ever written about the alleged creature, the author was none other than Jim Mars. He is a young journalist, probably in his 20s at that point. I mean, he wrote that first article. So Jim's even a more integral part, I think, to the history of the unusual than people realize. Another interesting thing about him is, although most people these days are castigated for having an interest in conspiracies or the unexplained, he actually taught college seminars and classes, night classes there, I believe at the University of Dallas, if memory serves. He actually taught college courses on the Kennedy assassination, as well as UFOs and the history of UFOs. And I think he did that up until a few years ago, which I didn't know until recently. I'd love to have been able to attend one of those conferences. But then again, I mean, getting to talk with him, and even after we spent a week together, you know, up here in Asheville years ago, which, interestingly, I think that all went down probably before Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule ever came out. That's how I got to know Nick Redfern, too, who wrote the foreword for the book. But, yeah, it was fascinating because it was one of my early experiences getting to meet Jim Mars and getting to know him. And he was always such a gracious guy. If I ever had a question or an idea I wanted to run by him, I had a question about monatomic gold one time, and I thought, who better to ask than Jim Mars? He was just this wealth of information, guys. He had knowledge on every subject you brought up. If you wanted to talk about Operation Paperclip, if you wanted to talk about cryptozoology, I remember sitting up at the Grove Park Inn talking about his book, Rise of the Fourth Reich, before it came out. And then we went to dinner. He and Nick Redfern, Joshua, and I, and my girlfriend Antonia, who's with me at the time, and she lives down there in Texas. I hope you guys will get to meet her at some point. She and her boyfriend John, they're wonderful people, and you know, she was close with Jim too. And actually, she got to do what we did. She went out and saw him right before he passed away at one of the events where he was. Sent me a picture of the two of them together. So, yeah, you know, he was very near and dear to a lot of us.
He was. I'm glad you brought up the fact of, like, you're talking about asking him anything. I remember standing there when I very first had met him and was talking to him and asked him a few things. And it was like Jim had a way of talking to you that seemed like it singled you out. Like, oh, whether yeah. there was people everywhere around, when he talked to you, it was almost like, and I said, it was like your grandpa. When your grandfather talks to you, it makes you feel like he's talking only to you. And that's what I appreciated. It seemed, I guess, the most about him is when he spoke to me, it was like it was just him and I there. Everybody else was gone. And everything he said, I mean, he was, you would think after all those years and all the people that he had spoken to and all the lectures he had given, that it would be old hat and it would just be going through the motions. And I could understand it. I mean, I could completely understand it if he was that way, but he wasn't. Every time he talked to anyone, it was like his sole mission was to educate them with the things that he had found. And I loved Jim for that. I mean, it was one of those deals. And Kyle and I both talked, our grandparents are both of our grandfathers are gone. So when we got to be around Jim, it was almost like we had a little replacement grandpa for a little while when you got to hang out with Jim.
That's a good way of describing it. Really is.
Well, and there's another thing too. And I know you've been busy. Let's talk about a little bit of the investigating around where you're at, what you've been doing, man. You've been looking into some ancient history stuff too while you've been killing time through the summer.
Well, you know, it's like what we said about Jim Mars. You know, a lot of people who are involved in this field, they have multiple interests. And I'm very much like that. I'm not somebody who has just, you know, one thing that I do. I mean, again, it's kind of funny because these days people probably associate me with UFOs more than anything. My first book, which I'm happy that this new edition is coming out because maybe it will kind of reintroduce a new audience and a new, gosh, almost... I mean, you got to keep in mind, it's coming up on a decade since I started writing the first edition, so it's been almost 10 years. But maybe a new audience will be introduced to that first piece of work that I did with this newer, you know, revised edition of it, which deals with these altered states of consciousness and these mystical experiences, something innate to humankind. It's interesting because lately, as you have alluded, I'm getting into archaeology, and I find that these two subjects complement each other extremely well. Because with magic, mysticism, the molecule, fundamentally, it's an anthropological study, I think, of, again, belief systems and also experiential data as it relates to unusual experiences people believe that they've had but seem to have been recounted throughout history. And it's a strange thing to me that at one time they were taken for granted as being an innate part of life, and in the modern era, because we can't measure them scientifically, capture them in a bubble and study them under a microscope, you know, they are dismissed as being non-existent, you know, wisps of smoke that were once the apparitions of yore. You know, anthropologically, we would say that these things are beliefs that were built upon totemic or maybe ancestor worship, any number of different things. Ghosts and similar unexplained phenomena are explained away in the same way. I argue that while indeed in many cases modern science does show us that a lot of the things we have believed in the past were beliefs that were believed for the sake of belief alone, and that were based in superstition rather than any kind of empirical evidence. But that may not be the case in all instances. You know, we don't have the demon Pazuzu that brings the crops, you know, or that brings the floods which allow the crops and things like what once was believed in the ancient past. Even really, I think, in some instances, prehistoric past. By definition. But what we do have today are the experiences people still describe having, like out-of-body experiences, things like that. So what does all that have to do with archaeology? Well, again, that's one half of it. Anthropologically, we look at cultures, we look at beliefs, we look at these kind of things. What drives me to be interested in archaeology is the actual physical component, where you dig up something from the earth that tells you things about the lifestyle and the belief system, the way of life of people who existed a long time ago. And, you know, I got to, right off the bat, this, I remember Graham Hancock, and he was at the famous debate with Zahi Hawass a couple of years ago. You guys remember this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Zahi Hawass storms out of the room because he didn't want to have the debate and everything. And Hancock says, for God's sake, we can't have the debate without Bavol. Bavol's a part of all this, you know. And so I've got to say, the entire discussion here has to do with a friend of mine, Jason Pentrail. And it's very much one of these, this part of the discussion, you know, I have to bring him up. I can't have this discussion without mentioning Pentrail. He would be the Bavall to my Hancock in that sense, because he and I met, he was a listener of my Graylian Report podcast, and he randomly messaged me, and he and actually Dakota Waddell and Caleb and I were playing a show with our bluegrass band down in Charleston, South Carolina, where Jason Pentrail resided at the time. And he said, you know, I'd love to be tour guide for a couple of hours. And so we're like, okay, sure, whatever, you know. And but the minute I called him, I thought, you know, I could tell this is going to be a cool guy. Boy, he wasn't just cool. He immediately takes us to an Irish pub, so we're all having Guinness. So I'm happy as a clam. But when he removed from his pocket the beautiful, almost obsidian black fossil megalodon shark tooth that was about the size of the palm of your hand. And he said, and this mic is for you. And he says, and soon I'm going to send one to you too, Dakota. I'm going to get you guys one. But that was such a gracious gift. I mean, I've never been at a bar with somebody I just met who, as a gift, brings me a megalodon shark tooth. And that's Jason Pentrail. He's one of the most conscientious, kind people. But he's also an educator. He reminds me in some ways, actually, of Robert Schock, in the sense that when he's talking, you can tell he's used to teaching people. And he's done a lot of teaching with me. He's taught me a lot. We get out and we'll work the creeks together. I found a huge megalodon shark tooth the other day in a creek with Jason right there. And it was funny because Tiffany Mack, you guys, you know, our dear friend Tiffany, she texts me as we're going into the creek and she says, oh my God, you're in the creek right now? Okay, FaceTime me. I want to see what's going on. And so Lady Luck is right there with me on FaceTime and I'm down in the creek. And it was incredible because I've only been out in the creek a few times with Jason, but he's trained me, and this, by the way, isn't the archaeological stuff. This is paleontological, okay? So let's get nomenclature out of the way. This is the paleontological side of it. But we're down in this creek, Jason and James Waldo, our geologist friend, and I, and Tiffany's there on FaceTime with me on my phone, and I'm like, okay, Tiffany, I'm going to show you what we're doing. And I swear, with her on the phone there, I start finding the shark teeth everywhere. And it was so cool because I'm able to show her, even though she's not able to be there. I'm like, Tiffany, look, watch. You see where my finger is? And I put my finger down into the water. I'm like, okay, now watch. And I'll pull up this shark tooth. And she was getting so excited and so happy to see these things. And even Jason was like, wow. But he's really helped me learn to, just like anything. It's like, you know, if you're out in the field, you know, you develop a game eye. Or if you're, you know, you're learning to appreciate art and you start spotting the nuances of the brush strokes and the texture of the paint as well as the image itself. Like anything, you have to develop that skill, but you start learning what to see. And when you're out there in the creek and you're looking for these paleontological wonders, these fossil shark teeth or, you know, whale vertebra, you never know what's going to turn up. I mean, we found a portion of the inner ear bone of a whale. I did. Jason helped find an entire fossil whale on one occasion that was gifted to the University of South Carolina. You just never know what you're going to find, but right before you find it, I noticed that there's this talk about altered states of consciousness, this moment where you just lock in and I feel a certain kind of, you can feel a distinct shift, guys. And I'll be down in the creek and I'll be looking and I'll know. I'm like, okay, now I feel it. And the mosquitoes are really bad. There's leeches swimming around trying to, you know, bite you. So you want to wear, you know, knee-high boots at least. And I'm standing there with bug spray all over me, but I'm also smoking a little cigar because that smoke, you guys know, you guys are fishermen. That cigar will really help keep those bugs away.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm crouched down in the creek. But there's this moment where you kind of let go and you feel yourself zone in and then you'll find something. Always happens, and it's incredible. And as I'm getting more adept at it, I talked with Jason about it, and he said, yeah, I've had a lot of people describe that, and I know what you're talking about. And I can only say it's like an altered state of consciousness where you feel all of a sudden something shifts, and then you're like, okay, and now I've like I would liken it to this, guys. It's like, imagine if there's water. I mean, you can't see what's in the water, but you put your face through the water, and all of a sudden you can see everything. I mean, it feels like that, where there's this distinct kind of change, and then you're able to see things. It's fascinating. I don't know exactly what mechanism of the brain that is I'm describing, but again, it's fascinating, and it's all a part of this. But what we're really interested in with the archaeology is, again, Paleo-Indian archaeology. We're talking about native people here in North America and also, of course, South America. That always seems to be left out of the equation in most of the literature, but I'm fascinated especially by South American sites, Puerto Fiorada, Monteverde, and some of the others. But our interest in Paleo-Indian cultures has to do with, again, well, a lot of things. First of all, I'm just fascinated with the lithic technologies. This, of course, involves the what were once called arrowheads, but these things actually predate bows and arrows. They would have been spear points in the ancient past, and the period we're talking about is maybe, you know, 10 to 11,000 years ago, but as far back as 14, 15,000 years ago, that 13,000 year mark really is kind of the sweet spot. And this, of course, the representative culture in North America would have been what we call the Clovis culture, but they are again identified by their lithic type, which is a, you know, very rough, fairly large spear point that has a distinct groove down either side, which is referred to as a flute. And there's nothing like holding one of these things in your hand and looking at it and saying, my God, this is 13,000 year old technology I'm holding in my hand. A human hand shaped this stone at least 11 or 12,000 years ago. I mean, there's nothing to me in this world like that. And it's incredible. I'll talk to people. I'll say, you guys ever look for arrowheads? Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, I used to do that. My aunt actually had a bunch of them. She drilled holes through them and made a necklace out of them. And I just want to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And people are taking thousands of years of lithic to these items, guys, represented the technological revolution of prehistory in North America. And honestly, you know, although the proper terminology when we're talking about a dark continent, this would be in reference typically to Africa, archaeologically speaking, but I would actually move that North America in a lot of ways is a dark continent because there is so much of the history of North America that we don't know. And to illustrate how little we know, I mean, again, this marvelous debate, Kyle, I know you were watching it. Cam, did you see it with Michael Shermer, with Randall Carlson, Graham Hancock, yes, and Joe Rogan?
Yes. Yeah, I remember that.
Now, you know, I know Randall Carlson quite well and have attended a couple of his private seminars at a location here in this region. He and I have gotten to know each other very well. I've met Graham Hancock on one occasion and spoken with him a good bit. So he knows at least who I am. I've never met Michael Shermer, but amazingly, here's the skeptic guy who's supposed to be representing conventional science, and he didn't seem to know anything about pre-Clovis in America, whereas in the archaeological community, I mean, the idea of Clovis first, that Clovis were the first people that came across the land bridge or however they got here, because that's also in dispute. That's been out the window for forever. And, you know, again, this is something that Jason Pentrail, with some of our mutual research, he's been really digging into the migrations. Who came to this continent? Where did they come from? How did they get here? I think Jason and I both lean toward not that the Beringia or the Beringian Bridge concept is outmoded or impossible, but that is, in addition to other entry methods, one way that people got here. And if anything, it seems like the evidence shows that the Clovis culture probably came from the south and up rather than across and down. And that these ancient people did, instead of just, you know, using land bridges and coming between the ice sheets at a specific time, in likelihood these people used watercraft and bounced along the shores. And so there's a lot that we're seeing. And during that debate, Michael Shermer didn't seem to be very aware of all this. He referred to Monte Verde in Chile repeatedly as Mesa Verde. He's confusing that with a site out west here in North America. It's really sad because even people who are extremely educated don't really seem to know, they don't seem to really understand that emerging archaeological evidence shows that people have been here in North America much longer than we thought. And there are disputed sites, like if we go to Hualco in Texas, or I'm sorry, in Mexico, Hualco, by some judgments, and this is based on radiocarbon dating, I mean, has been dated to 250,000 years ago, but that is very unlikely. That probably has to do with erosion, fluvial plains, floods, and things like that that have contaminated soil strata. But at least on the low end, there's reliable evidence that shows that Hualco was probably in nearby areas were inhabited at least 20,000 years ago on the lower side. So again, that's much earlier than that 13,000 year period. And we're finding that, of course, you know, again, people have been here, even if it's just as little as 20,000 years, much longer than we thought. Then you add to that this discovery out there in California from earlier this year, the Cerruti mastodon site, where they're saying there's good evidence, not just radiocarbon dating, but also distinctive human man-made marks on stone and tools and things and on bone from this site, and that both the stratigraphy and also the radiocarbon dating and other elements of this site determine a 130,000-year antiquity, which goes so far back, some are saying these could be Neanderthals that were here in North America. Now, that is extremely, extremely controversial. Much of the archaeological community will hear nothing of that. But, you know, friends of Jason's and mine, namely Dr. Albert Goodyear down in South Carolina, he has said and actually was interviewed by MSNBC about this, saying it seems like there's some good science to this. So, you know, again, I think the long story short is that we're learning that there's a lot more to North America than we once thought that there was. And even though this is good science and there's good science that supports this, I'm amazed at how many people who call themselves scientists don't seem to be really hip to this idea yet. So this is we're learning that North America is effectively a dark continent, and that we're learning things about it that we never knew and never thought possible.
Fascinating. I believe there wasn't there a site that just came to light again in Oklahoma that was originally discovered in the 1960s?
Yeah, you sent a link to me about that. And
yeah.
Again, there was a gravel pit at that site in question. And again, you know, I mean, we're talking about kind of, you know, generalities right now, but at some point, Jason Pentrill and I will have to come on together and really dig into some of this stuff. I think, you know, he and I'll have some projects and things, and it'll really be a conversation that we can really dig into. But the sites you're talking about out there in Oklahoma was a gravel pit. And again, there was what appeared to be evidence of an antiquity that went back several thousands of years like that. I mean, thousands of years before the Clovis. I think, though, the problem was that at the time that the site was first discovered, there was still some dispute. You got to keep in mind, again, it was once believed that Ice Age man didn't exist in the Americas. Elias Herdlicka, who was one of the primary anthropologists with the National Museum of Science, I mean, the Smithsonian, basically what it became, he absolutely wouldn't hear of Ice Age man in the Americas. And it wasn't until the discoveries at Folsom, New Mexico, that people began to say, oh, okay, wow, okay, well, now we have actual evidence of this. A flood washes through that area back in the early part of the last century. And then a black cowboy named George Majunkin is riding along Wild Horse Arroyo, and he sees something sticking out of the side of the bank. He goes over to investigate, and just so happens that he was not only a trained cowboy, but also he was a part-time musician. I mean, he had all these really great talents, and Majunkin just happened to have an interest in archaeology and paleontology. He couldn't identify these whitewashed bones. Took him around for years trying to get somebody to pay attention to it, and he finally passed away. But there was a guy who worked at a paint shop over there in town that Majunkin would go and talk with, who remembered what the black cowboy had always talked about seeing out there at Wild Horse Arroyo. And he takes a group of people, including a priest out there, an archaeological team. They go out there, they excavate, and they don't just find the bones, but they find these beautiful little quote-unquote arrowheads right there in situ alongside those bones. And what we find is right there on the side of the hill where it eroded out in the arroyo, I mean, there's a perfect stratigraphic sequence. What that means is that we see the layers of soil that are indicative of the periods, the geological age of the site. And that was the first way that we were able to understand the antiquity of these locations. And sure enough, George Majunkin had proven that there was evidence of Ice Age man in the Americas, the first guy to have found it. And it wasn't long after that that another site right in that same region near Clovis, New Mexico, was determined. A young man named James Ridgely Whiteman, who also was of Native American heritage. He had been, for a long time, written out of the history books, much like George Majunkin. But he had been the original discoverer of what he called warheads down there that he had found alongside extinct, what he believed were some sort of a mammoth bone. It took years to get attention from the scientific community, but when they finally got down there, they not only said, well, these are definitely Ice Age man, but they were from an earlier period than the Folsom culture. The Clovis were something distinct. And lo and behold, it turns out that William Clark, who had been dispatched to Big Bone Lick, Kentucky, even before all that, Thomas Jefferson had sent him out there to find evidence of extinct monsters and things, and they'd heard about a lot of these fossils there at Big Bone Lick, and hence the name. But he also found in situ with the mammoth remains there in the swamps, he found these fluted lithics. And lo and behold, it was several decades before we recognized, oh, you know what? Thomas Jefferson sent William Clark out there of Lewis and Clark fame. He found Clovis points. We just didn't know what they were. Yeah, Elias Herdlicka went to his grave apparently without ever acknowledging. Again, here's the preeminent man of science in the anthropological field of his day. Never acknowledged at all that Ice Age man had been here in the Americas. Wouldn't believe it, wouldn't accept it. And it took a long time for people to finally say, you know what, guys, it's right there in front of you. We can no longer deny this science. And so in the broader sense, I mean, this idea of paradigm shifts and things, you've got to have good evidence before a paradigm shift can occur. But I think that the most hopeful and the most disciplined and the most patient researchers out here, and I do hope to aspire to be one of those myself, you know, guys, I realize that we talk about fringe things from time to time, but, you know, you don't give yourself to something for the sake of belief alone. Science relies on evidence, but when you can provide that evidence and it uproots an old theory and you have to move forward with a new idea about things that you thought you knew, that's a beautiful thing. And that, my friends, is what we call a paradigm shift.
Man, that is incredible. Micah, before you go, are you aware of the London Hammer?
The London, Texas Hammer?
Yeah. You heard about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Pretty cool. What is your thoughts on that? I mean, this is what appears to be modern day like sledgehammer that was discovered like in 1936, I believe, near London, Texas. But it's stuck in this concretion of, I don't know what type of rock it is, but they think, that at least they know that the rock that it's encased in is like 400 million years old.
Well, actually, no. What's interesting is you used the money term right there. You said concretion. Now, while the if it were indeed stone that formed geologically, like other, you know, for instance, large granite slabs or something like that,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it might be that old. A concretion can actually form very quickly around. As a matter of fact, I've talked with a lot of collectors and people who they'll say that. And Jason Pintrill and I brought this subject up with him, and he was talking about this too. He said that he had spoken to a lot of people, Jason Pintrill, that will go out into a creek and they'll see, what looks like a kind of a corrosive, stony material that's built around, you know, old knives, spark plugs, all kinds of things like that. There was a famous artifact that was pulled up a number of years ago. It was for a long time referred to as the Koso artifact. It appeared to be a modern spark plug, but yeah. It was within a geode. Again, at the time, before we understood this process of concretion, geologically speaking, we looked at this and we thought, my gosh, are these evidence of a pre-existing or an earlier ancient advanced civilization? But in truth, again, there have been plenty of things that have been found that are of obvious modern origin, modern being the last couple of hundred years, that appear to be cased in stone. And that is indeed what happens when a concretion like that occurs. I can certainly tell you that the London Hammer is no out-of-place artifact from an ancient period. It is indeed a modern artifact. The concretion is recent, and I'll tell you why. Because if the hammer itself, even if it had been from an earlier period, the wood would have rotted away over 400,000 years. The wood was still intact on the hammer from which it was, with the concretion when it was pulled from that river. The wood wouldn't have lasted that long, guys. The wood was not fossilized either. So that was a recent hammer. It was a concretion. It wasn't 400,000 years old. I hate to burst people's bubbles, but again, that's the whole point. If we want to be able to make a credible argument, we got to understand the science and how things actually happen rather than what they appear to be.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in person. I was told that the handle itself was petrified. But like I said, I know it's in a museum not too far. It's in Glen Rose, Texas, actually, which is only about 37 miles from here, Skeleton Studios. I need to go down there and check it out, but it's at some creationism museum, and I've just never stopped by there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I'd actually like to get up to Kentucky. That's a whole other story maybe that we'll have to save for another time. But I'll tell you, Jason Pintrill and I, we have had our run-ins with creationists. I won't say anything more about that right now. But again, you know, it's incredible some of the things that people believe in. In relation to the London Hammer, I will definitely say that the London Hammer is something that, again, people who want to try and use that, rather than, well, what is it, and let's understand the science, they look at what it appears to be and they try to use that to bolster an illogical or pseudoscientific argument, which, sadly, my father's a minister, so I'm not trying to disenfranchise people who are of religious faith. I mean, I believe in a God. But I also believe that the Earth is older than, for instance, 7,000 and a half years old or so. And I don't think that you have to be either a person of science or a person of faith. The two can be complementary. There's a great book my dad always talked about, which is written by Paul Davies, and I believe that's called God and the New Physics. Again, you read books like that and you'll find that actually theology and science and philosophy can be entirely complementary. Martin Gardner, pronounced and one of the most vocal skeptics of his era, always maintained belief in a creator. And to each his own. Some people don't, and if you don't, that's fine. All the better to you. If you do, that's good, and you know what you believe based on, your experience in your life and the way that you see things. But I mean, again, I'm not going to tell people what to believe. I'm just going to say there's a difference between evidence and evidence-based thinking and then belief for the sake of belief alone. And when you go so far as to create an argument about something that is wrong to substantiate an equally wrong belief, that's a problem.
Yeah, well said. Well, what do you got coming up in the future?
I hope to be getting down to Texas to visit my bruds.
Yeah, there you go. I know you got a cruise coming up.
Yeah, we're going to be doing the Ancient Mysteries cruise, where I'll be talking about some of this kind of stuff. And again, I'm going to feel like a fish out of water without Jason Pintrill there to be able to, fill in the gaps. Again, he's the real brain when it comes to, he's just spent a life studying archaeology. And although I've studied a lot of archaeology and even more so history and things, I think, his technical knowledge of the archaeological side of things and my historical approach, it's very complimentary. So somehow I'll survive and I'll give that lecture without him. And then the Mysteries Cruise is the other cruise that's going to be happening in November. Really excited about that one because Matt Oakley, my co-host of the Graylian Report, is going to be joining us on the high seas, and really going to be a great time. But As a matter of fact, this week I'm leaving on Thursday to head up to Nova Scotia for the Paracon that's going to be there in Liverpool. And I'm going to be talking about this new edition of Magic Mysticism of the Molecule. So you heard it here first, folks, and then the folks in Canada are going to be the next round.
Yeah, well, tell everybody about your podcast and how to get a hold of you if they want to send you a message or something.
Absolutely, yeah. Graylian Report is the podcast. And again, Matt and I are the hosts of that show. We've been doing that off and on. Well, I've been doing it nonstop for, gosh, coming up on 8 years now.
Man.
Can you believe that? 8 years of podcasting. But Matt was actually with us since the second episode and took a few years off. And then the last couple of years, he's been back with us and going strong. So, yeah, that's where you can find that is Graylian, G-R-A-L-I-E-N, report.com. And then, of course, MicahHanks.com is my personal website where I've got some blogs and some things. And, of course, you know, our friends over at Mysterious Universe, good pals of yours and good pals of mine. I write for them, and I have for years because I like it, and they're good folks. So you can find my articles there at MysteriousUniverse.org.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thanks so much, Micah, for coming on. It's been far too long since we've had you on, and definitely far too long since you've been down here in studio.
Yeah, most definitely, but we're going to correct that, so I'll be seeing you guys soon.
All right, man. Have a safe trip to Nova Scotia.
Thanks, my bruds.
Peace. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Micah Hanks. I did. You know, I love to think about these trips, these ayahuasca or these mushroom trips. You know, there's evidence of these mushroom cults back in the day. And I find that stuff fascinating. I personally I would like to try ayahuasca, I think. I don't know if I would try it in the middle of the South American jungle, though.
Oh, yeah, you will.
Like, maybe if I was in Arizona or something like that, I could, you know, I can handle the rattlesnakes. I can handle, the Gila monsters. I can handle roadrunners, tumbleweeds, stuff. I don't know about the jungle, man. It's kind of a creepy place without taking any mind-altering drugs or chemicals. Like, with the bullet ants and the, I don't know, the centipedes that are 3 feet long and the anacondas and...
You'll do it when you get down here. You'll
do it. The leopards and stuff. I don't know. But I don't know. You know, I've experimented with mushrooms and things like that in the past when I was much, 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 much younger.
Yeah.
Much younger.
Last year before his birthday.
And, you know, so I know exactly what he's talking about when he's referring to these alternative worlds, these things you see. I think anybody who's tried anything mind-altering like that, you are a firm believer that we're not really sure what's going to happen to you when you die, but something's going on. You know, what I think is such a tragedy is things like DMT are illegal, but your body produces it. That's like saying blood is illegal or, you know, urine is illegal. Yeah. Your body produces DMT. So how can you make that illegal? I think, what's his name? The singer is always pointing that out. My mind just went blank.
Come on, Sturgill?
Yeah, Sturgill Simpson. He's always talking about it in his lyrics and stuff. What do you think about the mushroom cults and the ayahuasca and the sentient beings and the people that have contact with them?
It explains. If you go down that path, I still believe it explains a lot. I believe that if it's one of those things, I myself have dabbled in psychedelics, one of the entogens, you know, where I've dabbled in things along those lines. It's not something you should dabble in, especially at a younger age, and we've talked about it before. Don't, you know.
No.
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest it doing it as a young man, but old. I think it actually is a very helpful thing on many, many different levels. But yeah, I believe it does explain a lot of stuff. It's one of those deals that our consciousness, it's like you and I have discussed, you only have a handful of senses. So for us to be able to see certain things, we don't see in all the color spectrum. We don't, you know, we don't have the same sense of smell that dogs, you know, have. We don't have the things that other animals have. So they're seeing things we can't see. We're seeing and understanding things the way they can't see. Everybody's different. There's people who wear glasses. Other people don't wear glasses. So obviously you're already experiencing life differently. Well, why couldn't there be other things that our senses aren't picking up? So I believe that there could be something like that about it.
I like the idea of it, at least. Yeah. I mean, we know that throughout history, all these ancient cultures, they all were experimenting with this stuff. There was a local shaman in every village, and sometimes it was a rite of passage you had to do, you know, with what some kind of ceremony. I think that they knew that it was helpful. You know, like anything, if you abuse it, no, it can be terrible.
Yeah.
But if done right, I think you could, you know, whether meditation and practicing yoga, hot yoga, and a little bit of psychedelics every once in a while, I think is probably healthy. The main thing about psychedelics is, I'm not talking about doing hero doses, but, you know, small amounts and then doing it ever so often, is it's very self-reflective. It makes you look at yourself.
Microdosing?
Yeah, it makes you feel more accountable, which I think is what people really need, mm-hmm. especially people with huge egos and things like that. Kind of puts you in check. When you start seeing those things, you start realizing that you are a small, insignificant speck mm-hmm. in a large spectrum. And I think we lose sight of that sometimes.
The pale blue dot.
Especially Carl Sagan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he experimented with that stuff.
Yes, he did.
You know, we live in a society where we have a smartphone and you're wondering what's on sale at the Gap or the Banana Republic. You kind of, and yet we still complain. You know, you kind of lose focus of where you stand as a being in the universe.
Yeah.
And I think things like that will help you remind you about that. So, excellent author, excellent book. I suggest you pick it up, Mr. Micah Hanks. I also think you should check out his show. I'm sure that most people listening to our voices right now are aware of the Grayland Report.
Yes.
Him and Matt do an excellent job over there. Brud, mm-hmm. What else you got planned for when you get back?
Man, oh man. Well, we've got some other interesting interviews coming up for when I return from this whole deal. Anybody that, like I told the elitist, any of y'all that follow us personally on Facebook, mm-hmm. that follow the show on Facebook, if you follow us personally on Instagram or the show on Instagram, keep your eyes peeled because I'm going to be posting some things on there and I'm going to be using and videoing some of this, and I'll end up releasing it on YouTube too after we get back, of just some of the trip stuff, because I'm gonna be looking around at all kinds of wild stuff down there. But that's about it. I'm looking to have a little fun, looking to get away, because when we come back, I know that we've got a lot of stuff. You and I have got a lot of stuff planned for the end of the year for the show.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things. I know now y'all got plans coming up in November, but it's one of those deals that we've got a lot of stuff coming up that we're going to be changing or adding or just, you know, doing some stuff with the show. So we got to constantly innovate, and it's one of those things that we know there's a lot of work coming on top of all the work you've already been doing personally. So,
right?
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff fixing to happen.
Yeah, I'm busy, but I'm glad to be busy because if I have idle time, I tend to get in trouble.
Yeah, no joke you do.
Don't forget, folks, if you want to share some of your stories, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can also call the show, 817-945-3828. We also do an additional show, Expanded Perspectives Elite, that comes out every Friday. If you want to sign up for that, it's $5 a month. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab. Signing up is easy through PayPal. And you'll get an additional show every Friday, as well as access to the entire back catalog, at least for now. Also, don't forget about our sponsors, Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/expanded. And don't forget about Gaia, G-A-I-A. .com/expandedperspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expandedperspectives. You can go over there and check out one of a kind shows like False Flags with Richard Dolan, an incredible show, as well as my favorite Deep Space, as well as thousands of other titles. But you got to go over there and you got to use our code. We appreciate our sponsors. Our sponsors help us to produce these shows for free, because the bigger the show gets, the more data we use and equipment breaks down. And you know the deal. If you want to help out the show, you can always write us a review on iTunes. We're trying to get to the magical 500 in the United States. I think we're about 5 or 4 away. So send them in, folks. We would really appreciate that. I hope everybody has a good week. Don't work too hard. For you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Friday. For everybody else, we'll speak to you again on the next Monday. I'm your host, Kyle Filson, and he's your host, Cameron Hale. Hopefully, he comes back with no shark bites. If you do, and you're bitten in half and you're bleeding out, please.
Facebook Live it.
FaceTime that.
You're right. Send it to you. I'm not going to make it.
All right, folks. Take care.
Peace, y'all.